The next part of the program is going to be coming up in a minute, and I just wanted to talk about it briefly. So I was in California earlier this summer, and I have an old friend, my friend Mike Boss. I've known him since I was 10 years old, and he's always been this nature boy. In fact, he's a plant ecologist, a permaculturist, and he calls himself a certified plant geek, and he's the founder of the award-winning Rock and Rose Landscapes, which is based in San Francisco. And he recently founded the Edible Nursery Project. And we went into his garden at his home in San Francisco, and he showed me around to all the wonderful plants that he's growing and talked about how he's growing them and why he's growing them. I tasted some amazing things, and there's a bit of wind while we were in his garden. It is a windy city, San Francisco, so you might hear a little bit of the wind in the recording of this show. And then after the recording that you'll hear today, I invite you to visit my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, where you can see the remainder of this interview. We walked around his garden, and he'll show you the different plants and trees that he's growing. I really enjoyed it. It's so important not only to eat healthy, whole plant foods, but if you can and you have space, you can be growing some in your yard, even on a windowsill. We can be growing herbs and things, and the flavors and tastes of foods that are so fresh are better than anything. Okay, so I invite you to join me for the second part of this show right now with Mike Boss.
Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass with It's All About Food, and thanks for joining me today. We've got a very special interview for you. You may be able to hear it. I am sitting in Bernal Heights in San Francisco in the garden of my friend, Michael Boss. And I've known Mike for almost 50 years. It's kind of hard to believe.
Close to that.
Close to 50 years.
I think we met in fifth grade.
Yes, in Hebrew school, if you remember. Yeah, we were both 10 years old. Okay, so Mike went to Vassar College and studied biology, and then he got a master's at Syracuse in plant ecology.
Correct.
And I've always known you as someone who loved the outdoors. I remember when I visited you and you were getting your master's, you were doing a special project in Lake Placid.
Well, in the Adirondacks. Yeah, I was studying post-fire vegetation in subalpine forests of the Adirondacks.
And I took a bus to Lake Placid, and you picked me up there, and then you took me to your lean-to, where you were staying during the summer, and then gave me a tour of the woods around there. It was amazing.
The Adirondacks are a pretty special place, that's for sure.
So this show is all about food. And we're going to be talking about food. Now, one of the things is, as I mentioned, we're here in San Francisco, but you really have no idea that you're sitting in this urban environment.
Yeah, I mean, there's views in my garden here that you would think that we were in Sonoma County, not San Francisco.
Yeah, it's very calm, very peaceful, very lush, and very, oh my God, the blue sky is clear. We're sitting under the shade of... What kind of tree is that?
This is a Monterey cypress.
Of course, it's a Monterey cypress. No food from there.
Well, you can make flour with the pollen. You can collect the pollen. Of course, it's a little bit high right now. You'd have to jump real high.
This guy is a wealth of information, and it's always such a pleasure to get little tours. So we got a little tour of the garden here. And, okay, so let's just go back for a minute. Why did you study biology?
It was really about plants and gardens that got me into it. My mother was an extraordinary gardener, and I didn't even realize at the time, but that seeped into me. And our family vacations were always, my father was a school teacher, so A, we didn't have very much money, and B, we had summers off, so we would go camping. And that's where I just developed my love of the woods, even though I grew up in suburban Long Island.
Yes, many of us grew up in suburban Long Island and went in very different paths. Now, you founded a landscaping company here in San Francisco called Rock and Rose. And I'm smiling when I say that name. I love that name.
Well, you helped me come up with that name, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. And that's how long have you had that business?
Since 1989. So that's almost 3 decades.
Yes. And now you're pursuing or thinking about pursuing some other things in addition to Rock and Rose, and we'll talk a little bit about that too. So let's get into the food here.
All right.
And let's just start first with your garden.
So this garden would be described as a food forest garden. A food forest is a permaculture concept, and basically the classic food forest means that you have food produced at multiple strata in the forest, in the garden, not just vegetables in a bed, annual vegetables, but an overstory. The classic would be maybe having an overstory as a walnut tree, an understory as a persimmon tree, shrubs as blueberries, perennials as artichokes or rhubarb, ground covery plants like strawberries, and maybe you have a passion flower vine growing up through it. I'm not crazy about the term food forest, especially here in a Mediterranean climate where forests are not the same as the forests back east, and everyone has a different concept of a forest, but that's one of the permaculture principles, is that it all depends. So where you are, and basically, so permaculture, permanent agriculture morphed into permanent culture. It's a concept that came out of Australia by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren in the early 70s, hit North America in the late 70s. And basically a definition that I've heard, there's a lot of definitions, and that's very arguable what the real definition is, and there is no such thing. But it's a design approach to building systems that support human settlement according to the principles of nature.
Human settlement according to the principles of nature. I don't think most of us are doing that today.
No, as a matter of fact, we're not, and that's why a lot of the problems that in our society are coming from, are facing us.
We are so separated from nature. We are, many people don't even want to be in nature. They're almost afraid of nature.
Yeah, the nature deficit syndrome.
Is that a coined phrase?
Yeah, that's the thing.
NDS.
So, especially, you know, we're so addicted to our electronics, and few of us actually get out anymore, except to go to get lattes.
Right. I remember asking one of my nephews when he was very young where the apple came from that he was eating, and he said, Publix, which was the local grocery store.
Sure. Food comes from, everyone knows what aisle in Safeway the food comes from.
Yeah, but a lot has to happen before it gets there.
Oh, my God. And so that's one of the things that I am trying to work on right now, is to have awareness about that. So for every apple that you eat, here in San Francisco, most of our apples are grown out in the Central Valley in these big agro farms, giant corporate farm food factories, in sterile environments because of all the herbicides and pesticides that they spray to keep us the fruit from being absolutely beautiful. And then that fruit gets picked by people, not often making a whole lot of money, and then it gets shipped to a processing plant, think of burning a fossil fuel, and then it goes from the processing plant to a distribution center, think
more
burning
fossil fuel,
yes, and then to the Safeway distributing plant, to then the Safeway, and then we drive to the Safeway to go and pick up the food. So that's the environmental footprint. That's only part of the environmental footprint, not to mention the fertilizers and the pesticides and the production of those, versus picking an apple from your backyard
and eating it.
And it's going to be fresh.
I love it. And we're going to be eating some of the other foods that you have in this garden.
I have a little pile right here beside me. And why don't we start with a more traditional, well-known plant, the Santa Rosa plum.
The Santa Rosa plum.
Developed by Luther Burbank, not that far from here, up in Sonoma County. And this came off of the tree that's right over here, and you see it's loaded
with fruit. I'm just looking at it. It is so beautiful, and it's overloaded. All those pinkish purple dots all over.
Would you like to have a bite?
I would.
You would?
Yep.
It's juicy.
Mmm. Mmm. That's good. Oh, that's so good. Look at that. It's full of color. And, you know, another thing that people don't really realize, when you pick some fruit off of a tree or pick it off the ground because it's fallen and it's warm out and you taste the warm fruit, you know, not like cold out of the refrigerator, there's nothing like it.
Oh my God, there's nothing like it. So I grew up eating dried figs that you got in a round and packaged, and I would love those. Those are really good, and it was a long time before I ever had a fresh fig. And now, at least in progressive markets, you can often find fresh figs. But there is nothing like eating a sun-ripened, warm fig right off of the tree in the garden. So this is a fig tree that's right over here, just a few feet from us. And it's a fig called Desert King. Green fig. This is the Breba crop, which is the first season crop. It'll have a second crop later in the year.
Mm.
Figs are very fascinating plants. They're Mediterranean plants, and they're very different. The varieties are very different in their cultural requirements. So here in cool San Francisco, a lot of the figs, like the Mission fig, doesn't really grow very well. But Brown Turkey, Desert King, and Violette de Bordeaux.
Très bien.
Merci. Beautiful fig. I mean, how could you not eat a Violette de Bordeaux? I mean, that sounds so sexy. You just want to lick it.
Yeah.
But it's a black fig, dark fig with a really deep red interior inside. And it tastes as sexy as it sounds.
Yeah, well, I was going to say this one looked pretty sexy too. There's something about these figs. Do you have different kinds grafted on this tree?
No, only one. I have not gotten into grafting. Grafting is a wonderful way to increase your variety of fruit without taking up additional space. I've been at a friend's house who has an apple tree that's got like 25 different varieties of apple grafted on the one tree. And that would extend your eating season because you would graft early ripening apples or fruit and mid-season and then late season.
So the fascinating thing about the plant kingdom and eating plants and focusing on eating plants is there seems to be an infinite variety. And when you go to the supermarket, there's only so many kinds that we're all familiar with. But if you travel around the world, very often you get to discover some fruits and vegetables that are more popular in that area, and that's a fun way to discover more of them. And then there are some that we've just lost. But you're growing some things here, right here in San Francisco, that I've never seen or heard of before.
Yes. There's a lot of things. And what's amazing is how many varieties of fruit and food, not only fruit, but roots, fruits, and shoots, are available and can be grown in here and also wherever you are. There are plants that will be growing that you never even heard of that will do really well. So here's a fruit that you would only know about this if you've been to South America, most likely, and eaten it there because it's not commercially viable. Because it doesn't store. When it gets ripe, it gets squishy really, really quick.
It's not a well-behaved shipping fruit.
No, it's not a delicious apple, which was bred because of its shipping qualities and its looks, as opposed to its taste. If you've ever had a delicious apple, they looked great. And they're not... Well,
they don't taste good.
They're not my favorite apple
pithy.
By any means.
That's the word I have.
So, here, why don't you try this sapote?
So that is... creamy on the inside.
How would you describe the creaminess flavor?
Well, this one It's very light. I'm trying to figure it out. You know, sometimes when you try something new, it takes a while for your tongue or your taste buds to even know what you're eating.
For me, it kind of tastes like a creamy, sweet, juicy banana.
It has, it's banana-like. Mm-hmm. I definitely get the banana notes.
The only fruit that I know of that's anything like this is called a cherimoya, which you see more often, big fruit.
Mm-hmm. Those are good.
They're like $8 per fruit in the store.
Right.
And it's on the order of a custardy apple. Custard apple.
Mm. Would you like to try some? Very good.
So while we're on fruits, I have another wonderful fruit here.
Oh, I love these.
This is called the Cape Gooseberry, and it's not a gooseberry if you've had gooseberries. It's just called that. They're starting to be appearing in the markets without the husk on it, and it's a relative of the tomatillo.
So I love it. It's like delicately packaged with a light paper.
Yes, and you open it up and reveal a wonderful fruit inside. Mm-hmm. So, here, this is for you, Karen.
You're going to take my sapote?
Yes, I'm going to finish it off.
Okay, now I've had a few of these, and I'm going to try this one now. What I love about this, it looks like a little cherry tomato. It has a tomato flavor, but there's this vanilla cinnamony, I don't know what it is. What do you think? I think it would make a great, well, it's great on its own, but a pie.
Yeah, you would need a lot to make a pie, and you could grow a lot because they're really prolific and they produce fruit really easy. The one that I planted and I just picked this off of, I planted a month and a half ago, and I get a dozen of them a day or every time I come out.
It's vanilla.
I think
like vanilla.
It's a must. I think it's a must-have in a San Francisco food garden.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty plant, sprawls. It's a relative of the tomatillo, as I said, which is often used for making salsas. But this has some sweetness in it, so it's a delicious fruit.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Isn't this exciting?
So there's the fruits. We've dealt with some fruits. Let's go with some shoots.
Okay, now shoots.
Shoots.
Don't shoot me. Let's do the shoots.
I'm going to shoot you good. what we mean by shoots are leaves. Of course, you know, the classic leaf that you get is an iceberg, a head of iceberg lettuce. About a little less on nutrition than a lot of other things. And
it's good on crunch.
Yeah, got some crunch. Definitely got some crunch. But,
and it's a good hydrating vegetable because it's full of water.
How about this is a little shoot of a plant called Malabar spinach. It grows in subtropical regions of Africa, and it's a vine. Here, let me...
Okay. Malabar spinach. It's a thick leaf. It's got a little more muscle to it than our spinach that we get.
Yeah, while it's called spinach, it's not related to spinach at all. Only spinach because it's a leaf.
Mm-hmm. It looks like... what does it look like? It's a light avocado color, obviously, but it, okay. It doesn't necessarily look like spinach, but it...
It's a little bit succulent.
Yep.
It's very palatable, just without cooking, add it to a salad for...
It does taste like spinach. I mean, maybe because you called it a Malabar spinach. I'm thinking of spinach, but it does have a spinach flavor.
So, another edible green, another shoot. Tree collards, and this is the purple variety, which adds visual interest in the garden. It's a nice
and nutrition,
purple,
because purple comes with some good antioxidants.
So this is something that you could eat raw, or what I like to do is I like to take the leaf, and there's a technical term for this that I forget what it is.
Chiffonade. You roll up the leaf.
I'm chiffonading.
And then slice it in thin ribbons.
And then I'll put it into anything that saute, a stir fry, and only cook for a couple of minutes.
Now, this is a tree collard.
Tree collard.
But it's not related to the collard.
No, it's more related to a mustard. It's in the brassica. And I'm not sure if Swiss chard is a brassica or not. But this There you go.
Okay, here we go. It's green and purple and kind of muscly. I'm wondering what it would be like if I massaged it in my salad. Like kale. Mmm.
Yeah,
it's chewy. Tastes like kale.
If you like kale, this is a mm-hmm. kale, this is a kale substitute.
Mmm. Fantastic.
And this gives right here, this greens all year long. There's not, you can't not get greens.
Wow, that's great. Now, now it grows all year long here in San Francisco.
Yes.
Which gets cold, but not too cold.
Correct.
Right. Yeah. Like if I try to grow this in New York.
New York. No, I think you'd have to bring it in for the winter.
Okay. Because some kales do well up until like January and February, actually, on the East Coast. But then the frost gets them.
So, this is a edible chrysanthemum.
Mm.
Chrysanthemum coronaria. And it's common in Asian cuisine, cooking. Put it in stews and soups.
Mm. Had a very fresh, fresh scent. Have you ever had it in... Do any of the restaurants, have you seen it?
I have a Japanese friend, and he's had it.
It's tasty.
He's had it.
I want to say lemony, but it's got a little brightness to it, the flavor. Very nice. Now, is this a perennial?
No, this is an annual here. This is a... I'm nothing against annuals. I'm focusing on perennials in my work. So it's called Shunguku.
In Japanese?
Yes.
Shunguku.
So it starts to get into the... What I'm trying to do right now with gardens is to use these perennial edible plants as structural elements in gardens. So instead of planting pansies, why not get your color from something like this that you could actually eat? So we start stacking functions, another permaculture principle. So single elements have multiple functions in the garden, whether it's structural, whether it's screening, or color. And as long as we're talking about flowers, it's important to note that you don't want every plant in your garden only to be edible, because really what we're trying to do is creating a natural ecology, doing things according to the principles of nature, the ecology of it all. So we need pollinators.
Hmm.
Here, you know, there's a lot of pollinator plants. Salvias are native to this area. And are a big source of pollinators. There's many, many, many plants, and they're going to vary by region. So,
What is a pollinator plant?
It's a plant that will attract insects that would cause pollination. So things that attract honeybees, for example. Now, honeybees are not native to most regions around here, but if you use the native plants in your location, you will attract native pollinator species of insects and birds that will pollinate your fruit trees. So, and you need to have sources of nectar all year long. So to plan a real true food forest garden that's functioning, you would get pollinator attracting plants that are blooming throughout the season. And natives are a big source of those because of the native insects, or mostly the insects that are there.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about big agriculture, the industrial agriculture that grows our fruits and vegetables. And there are lots of people that study in universities on what the best methods are to grow our fruits and vegetables in this manner. And we're finding that we're losing colonies of bees. We're losing colonies of pollinators. And yet you're telling me, and I'm seeing here, I mean, I see the bees. They look very happy, thriving. I know other people that are growing in their biodynamic, organic farms and gardens. They have no problem with the bees. And yet our big ag experts can't seem to connect the dots between the toxins that they're putting in their fields that are either killing or at least making the bees want to go somewhere else.
They're actually killing them. They're spraying, I think it's called...
neocotinoids?
Yes.
I don't know if I pronounce it correctly, but they're deadly.
Yes, yes. And they're killing bees by the millions.
When you set up a scenario like this, working with nature, not against nature, you have so much abundance and everybody's working together. You want your soil to be alive. Hi, who's this?
This is Peach.
Hey, Peach. We've got a little cat here. Meow.
Meow.
Okay, so what were you going to show me next? It's one of our shoots.
So stacking functions. One of those functions is about beauty. We talked about food, we talked about pollinator, and what about beauty? Because we are people, and we are attracted by beauty, and it stimulates us, and we are drawn to it on many different forms. So, the flowers, and also the leaves of the plants, and so what I'm trying to do is to really make beautiful gardens with edible plants. Mm. So, these are chives, and everyone thinks, oh, vegetable gardens, boring. But using the chive in a garden, as you would a flowering perennial, why not?
Sure, can I eat this?
Yeah, it's a little, as they go to flower, they get a little bit woody, but take a little bite of the flower.
Oh, the flower, I can eat the flower.
Yeah, you can put the flower in salads. Talk about a beautiful salad. Who wants to eat salads?
Make it beautiful. Oh my God, that's so good. I remember we grew chives on our terrace briefly, and I was so surprised when this flower came up.
There you go.
It's just stunning.
So probably this bud is going to be really delicious.
You're going to let me have it? No, you. Okay, you can have it. This is great.
Really mild onion flavor.
Mm-hmm.
It's like chives in your... Oh, it is chives in your salad.
Right, it's fantastic. You chop a few of these up in a little silken tofu, and you have a great spread.
Back to plants that may repel insects. I think more powerful is developing an ecosystem that will support itself. So when you have an ecosystem and you're not spraying insecticides, even organic insecticides kill.
Yep.
When you avoid that, you start allowing the ecology to work, and predator insects start coming and keep things in check.
Aphids beneficial insects.
There you go. Aphids are a big problem, particularly on the tree collards. You have to watch it. But there are a lot of bugs, lacewing beetles, soldier beetles lacewing larvae, soldier beetles, and ladybugs will just plow through the aphids. So here what we have to do to keep out, to allow those to get here is to keep out the ants. Because ants are actually herders. Mm. Like we herd sheep and we cultivate sheep, ants do that to the aphids and they will attack any predator insect. So now we have to do some ant control. And if you can't get to that, you don't need to spray diazinon or even safer soap. Or neem oil, all of that will kill aphids, but how about just a forceful jet of water knocks the aphids off, and there you go. Low impact insecticide, if you will,
right,
called water.
Water, a forceful jet of water. Wow.
Yep.
Who invented that, Mike?
I don't know, but not me.
Yeah.
Hey, would you like to take a walk in the garden?
I would. Let's go. Okay. That's the end of our show for today, everybody. If you would like to hear the remainder of this interview, please join me on the tour of my friend Mike's San Francisco garden. You can view the video and see all the roots, fruits, and shoots we've talked about at my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Karen Hartglass. This has been It's All About Food. Have a delicious week.
Bye.